The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. This is Desiree Shell, and today we'll be talking about the Canadian government's relationship to science. Spoiler alert, it's pretty bad. You will probably be depressed. And we're sorry. But after that, we'll be interviewing Chris McDonald for a brief primer on critical thinking, so that you'll know what to watch for when you read those science news articles in the paper. Although government scientists aren't really allowed to talk to media anymore. So enjoy. I'm here with John Dupuis, who is a science librarian at York University in Toronto. He's also the blogger behind Confessions of a Science Librarian, where his main interests lately are open access and the state of science in Canada. And he is sincerely hoping that one day those two passions will intersect. Great to have you here, John.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here.
So you wrote a post which was horribly depressing recently called The Canadian War on Science, a long, unexaggerated, devastating chronological indictment. And those are your words, not mine. If that title isn't self-explanatory enough for anyone, what's the post about?
What I've been doing for the last bunch of years is kind of watching the science scene in Canada. And just watching how things change, watching how things evolve. And certainly, I think, over the last bunch of years since the current Conservative government came into power, I think there's been a steady, I guess I use the word war as because it's kind of fun to use a provocative word, but there's been a steady assault on the kind of work that science people do, and the kind of work that librarians do, the kind of work that statisticians do. I like to kind of phrase it more broadly as a war on evidence. And so what I've been doing is I've been kind of tracking that war on evidence. And so every once in a while on my blog, I'll say, okay, here's something that happened. Here's somebody wrote a report about the federal government muzzling scientists that do environmental work. And so that's what I've been doing. I've been chronicling those. And my impression, I guess, through the first half of 2013 was that somehow this kind of drip drop I'd been seeing over the course of the last number of years had seemed to kind of radically accelerate. And all of a sudden, pretty well every day, I was seeing something new online or in the papers or on Twitter or somewhere saying, oh, this science program got shut down, that science program got budget cut, the NRC got this thing that happened, and it just seemed to be accelerating. So what I did was I kind of took my librarian skills and I said, let me see what's going on here. And so I went back through all the stuff I've been doing. The earliest tracking of this that I'd done was around 2008. And so I went back through all those old posts and I started saying, okay, this happened, that happened, that happened. And I started looking through a bunch of other things I'd saved, you know, and this was over the course of about 2 months. And the list was pretty impressive. I had about 70 things on my initial cut of the list. And 70 different program cuts or whatever. And so I assembled them all into this chronological post, item by item. And I've done this with a bunch of other things that had happened, either things at Library and Archives Canada or when Aaron Swartz committed suicide, where I'll bring together a bunch of posts around an issue and present them chronologically.
That's, and I really need to point this out to people. We're going to link to this on our website, but I would suggest you don't read it all at once because it would drive you to drink. It is atrocious.
Can I just add one little bit? Because there's one thing that I find really extraordinary about what happened. After I posted that first cut of around 70, well, you know, I tweeted the link and whatever, and it sort of went a little viral, at least for me. I've gotten close to 40,000 page views, which is actually pretty darn amazing for me. And, you know, I don't know if you check the post today, you'd see there's 114 comments. Now, a good chunk of those comments are suggesting things that I missed. I got emails, I got tweets, comments, all kinds, you know, people, the floodgates opened. And well, a lot of the things that people suggested were duplicates of things that I'd already found. But I added another 30 or so to the list. So now it's about 100. So essentially what happened was the second cut at this post got crowdsourced. And all of Canada, well, you know, a small chunk of Canada, helped me make this list bigger. And in fact, I've got probably another 10 or so for a third cut at the list. And so it's keeping on, keeping on. It's pretty astounding.
Well, I'm glad that there's something good that has come out of this. Well, let's go through some examples.
Sure.
Okay, so January 2008, let's start right at the beginning. The Office of the National Science Advisor was phased out. So what happened there?
The science advisor at that point was someone named Arthur Carty, who was a very respected person in the science world. He'd been appointed by Paul Martin. And so what the science advisor did was essentially advise the government on science matters. And it was kind of an interesting position. It was a link between policymakers and researchers. So through the science advisor, I guess the research community of the country could influence, advise, whatever, the government. And, you know, it's hard to know how useful or influential that had been in the past, right? Sometimes it's hard to judge those things. But the fact that you would have someone like this, I think, tells you that, yes, the government is at least willing to listen. And yeah, and so the Conservatives, that's, you know, in January 2008, that would have been one of the, you know, that was one of the first things that I found that they'd done. I think it was pretty telling when they phased out that office. He retired and he wasn't replaced.
Well, what kind of impact did it have?
You know, it's hard to say. It's hard to say because, right, we don't know what he would have advised the government to do differently now, and we don't know whether or not the government would have listened to him anyways. I think it's telling that they ended the position, because once you end a position like that, then you're basically saying that you don't think that there's any advice worth hearing from this science community. What's the impact? Hard to say. You would have to imagine that a lot of the things that we're going to go through that have happened in the last bunch of years, that whoever that national science advisor was would have said, don't do that.
March 2010. Information restrictions brought in by government severely restricted the media's access to government researchers. Explain that.
That's kind of an interesting one. And one of the threads that runs through the whole list is controlling public access to the science that's done by government researchers. Actually, if people want to check the Democracy Watch website, and I have, that's the link, that there's a link on the list that has a very large list, 130 something pages of incidents where government scientists were effectively muzzled. And so the thing that this is around, and this is mostly affected people that do environmental research, climate change and that sort of thing, interview requests that scientists get have to be first cleared through the Prime Minister's office or a media office or something like that. And so what this means is, if you want to, you know, if you want to talk to somebody in Environment Canada about climate change, you have to ask the government first. You have to ask some political flunky whether or not you can talk to that scientist. And so that creates this huge barrier between, well, you, I mean, I'm sure you would love to be able to interview Canadian government scientists.
Yes, please.
Yes, please, for sure. The more the merrier. But again, you would have, if you wanted to interview somebody at Environment Canada, you would have to go through the government. Literally, there have been cases where Canadian government scientists have been followed around by political flunkies at conferences. So it's kind of crazy. And this has been since around 2007 that this has been happening. And it's at that point that the government started requiring the federal scientists to seek permission before giving interviews. Or again, for, you know, if an interview request comes in, it's got to go through the government. Peter Kent, right, the Minister of the Environment, you know, has publicly declared that he thinks this is a good idea. And then, in fact, he has said that he thinks scientists prefer it this way.
Well, but did they?
No. I know, you're almost speechless, right?
I have a feeling I'm going to spend the entire interview sighing in a very exasperated way. I'm wondering, though, now, what was their reasoning? What was their stated reasoning for doing this? I'm sure they had something else, but besides the scientists want it that way.
I think the stated reason is around making sure that the scientists stick to the science as opposed to start wandering into the areas of public policy.
Right.
No one ever worried about that before. Scientists tend not to go off on about public policy anyways, right? I think that's the stated reason, but I don't, you know, who knows? We know what the reason is, but they're not going to say we don't particularly believe in climate change, so we don't want our scientists to talk
about
it.
Right. That's why I said stated reason, as opposed to the one that I was assuming it was. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to science librarian John Dupuy about the Canadian War on Science. All right, skip ahead a little bit to June 2010. Statistics Canada discontinues the mandatory long-form census. So maybe start with why is the census important from a science perspective?
Well, again, I think this goes to, again, that kind of war on evidence. One of the things that I did in my list was I actually stuck pretty close to science. Mm-hmm. I didn't even mention a lot of the things explicitly on my list about Library and Archives Canada, because it's not really science. But I felt I had to put the Statistics Canada in there. Well, first of all, you know, the discipline of statistics is a scientific, generally considered kind of a science-y kind of discipline, like most pure math fields are.
Mm-hmm.
Pure applied math fields. So the work is done by science people. What they generate is effectively social science information. Why did I include it? Because, again, like I said, I think the people that do the work are science people, as opposed to, again, you know, generating the social science data. I think it's also, perhaps of all the things that the Conservative government have done, I think it's the most evocative of the mindset. Because really, when you think about it, who uses the StatsCan data? It's largely businesses. So this is, you know, because let's say you want to open up a shop in the neighborhood, right? You want to know, okay, I'm opening a shop, and the kind of thing I'm going to sell appeals to a certain demographic. Well, you want to know about that demographic in your neighborhood. And in fact, that's that kind of information is the information that was most damaged by discontinuing the mandatory long-form census. That detailed neighborhood-by-neighborhood analysis. For example, and the reason for this is, in typically when the census was mandatory, they would get about a 94-ish percent completion rate on the long-form census. Well, the reason we know this is actually very topical, right, because the census information from the most recent one just came out in the last few weeks.
Yep.
Well, this time they only got about 68%. And what that's done is it's really damaged the reliability of the data, in particular at that kind of micro detail level. So the data is a lot tougher to analyze than it used to be. In particular, when you try and focus in on individual neighborhoods, that's where the data falls apart and becomes much less reliable. At 68%, if you're looking province-wide, you know, nationwide, it's pretty good. When you start to get to smaller areas, that's where it falls apart. For example, for the 2006 census, there were only 200 Canadian municipalities where StatsCan said, look, we weren't able to get, you know, these municipalities are so small, we weren't able to get good enough, represented enough data to be able to release the statistics for this municipality, around 200. Well, in the most recent census, that was over 1,100 municipalities now. And so these are all going to be small municipalities, probably with less than 25,000 people. But still, right, you might want to open up your restaurant in a small town, right? And so all of a sudden, you don't have that demographic data. And that's because, and the even worse part about this, and again, right, this is, you know, the statistical analyses, like I said, are mathematical, they are scientific. One of the worst parts about this is when the long-form census was made non-mandatory, the people that were most likely not to fill it out were mostly marginalized groups like low-income. And so all of a sudden we have our data on people that we would like our social services to be able to serve better. All of a sudden, the data is worse.
That's one thing I was wondering about, because I remember when they did remove the long-form census, a lot of nonprofit groups were talking about how their funding was highly dependent on those numbers.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a tragedy what happened. And every year, every census that if we restore it and we do another 100 years, the fact that we missed 1 year is probably not going to be the end of the world. But every census we miss damages our ability to analyze historical trends. It's really just devastating. It's hard to underestimate the impact that this is going to have. And again, right, the advice that the government got from, you know, the head of Stats Can at the time when the change happened was Munir Sheikh, again, a statistician, right, a science person. He said this is a terrible thing. He quit because it was such a terrible thing. He knew the damage that this was going to do to the social fabric of the country. And that's because, again, right, this lack of this attack on evidence.
Okay, let's move on to the next horribly depressing thing. I'm never going to make it.
I think we need a bunny rabbit break or something. Can we have like auditory kitten pictures or something?
That's what we need. We need memes. Okay, so August 2010, cuts to Environment Canada Weather Service programs compromised the government's ability to assess climate change and left it with a profoundly disturbing quality of information in its data network. Do tell.
This is something that had been kind of bubbling under for a long time, even back to the Liberal years. So yeah, this is basically trying to save money on collecting really detailed climate data, which is good for infrastructure maintenance and that sort of thing. And so that kind of stuff, yeah, it's really good to have. But again, if you do want to see climate trends and see how the climate's changing over different parts of the country, you need extremely detailed information. And again, over time, that capacity has been you know, really reduced, and it's again, it's just one of those things that's really critical. And again, once you don't, you know, once you have a bunch of years where you don't collect data, you can't go back.
Okay.
No, you can't replay the weather.
Well, and that's what I wanted to know. So how do we understand at this point how that has affected our understanding of climate science? Like, can
you know,
we see the effects yet, I guess? Is
probably not. Okay. Right, this is where you'd want to be able to get through to one of those Environment Canada scientists, right?
Oh, those guys. I remember those guys.
Right, the ones that they won't let you talk to. I don't have a good handle on how long it takes for this to become something that starts to affect your decision making. But again, right, the government doesn't really particularly want to use data to make their decisions anyways.
Okay, so let's keep talking about climate science since we're right here. For anybody who has somehow forgotten this, in December 2011, Canada withdrew from the Kyoto Accord.
Right. And you know, this one's, again, this is a kind of an interesting one. And just to maybe kind of backtrack a little bit, and a bunch of the stuff that a bunch of the stuff on the list, it's really depressing to look at the whole list.
Why, yes, right? It is. I need a drink.
Me too. And it's even later here. It's drinking time here in Toronto. But anyways, so basically when you look at the list, right, if you start picking out things, you think, you know, all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, taken as a whole, it's pretty devastating. But if you focus in on any single one, right, government programs just have life cycles. Right. Sometimes it just makes sense to shut things down,
right,
or to cancel a program, or to say, or to look at, you know, maybe the way you're staffed in a certain area and say, we don't need to be staffed that way anymore. And sometimes, you know, you look at, okay, the Conservatives did this, but, you know, really they did it because it was something the Liberals did 10 years ago.
Right.
That, and the Kyoto thing is so totally on the Liberals. Because because it was a Liberal government, I think under Chrétien, that signed the Kyoto Accord, mm-hmm, but then did nothing to try and hit the necessary emission targets and cuts. And so, yes, by the time we hit 2011, there was no way we could meet our targets. And so at that point, yes, the Conservatives just withdrew Canada from the Kyoto Accord. Right, they obviously had no interest in making anything any better anyways.
Right.
I think that's fairly safe to assume. But when you look at this one thing here, withdrawing from the Kyoto Accord, I think that one is That one's on the liberals as much as on the conservatives, because the liberals set the stage way back in the day for, in 2011, it not making any sense for Canada to be part of the Kyoto Accord.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is science librarian John Dupuy, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by John Dupuy, author of the science blog Confessions of a Science Librarian, who recently wrote a blog post titled The Canadian War on Science. Okay, so looking at your list, I scroll down through 2012, and it's basically just characterized by cuts and closures.
Right.
Too many to talk about to really even scratch the surface. So let's talk about some of them maybe that you'd like to highlight, the Experimental Lakes area.
Right. And 2012 is kind of interesting because, perhaps not coincidentally, it coincides rather nicely with the Conservative majority government. Right.
Yeah.
And it coincides, and a lot of the things that we see in the list in 2012, a lot of that is stuff that got buried in the big omnibus budget bills.
Right.
This was, this is one of those things where I have to thank the forensic crowdsourcers out there for helping me track down a lot of the citations for a lot of this stuff. So yeah, 2012, Experimental Lakes area, Northern Ontario near the Manitoba border. It's a set of lakes where what the scientists, and it's not actually that expensive a program to run. It's only, a few million dollars a year. So essentially what they do is they have all these lakes and they'll run 10, 20, 30 year experiments on these lakes. They'll say, okay, if we add a couple bottles of mercury to this lake every year for 10 years, how much mercury is in at the end? How much mercury can we detect in the plants? And so they're able to do these kinds of environment. They're able to effectively run long-term experiments on the environmental impact of various things that they want to do. And there's tons of lakes that are part of this area, and there was tons of experiments that they were running. Now, this is kind of a good news story, in a way, because even though in the 2012 budget, the government targeted the Experimental Lakes area for closure, and it was a huge uproar. This is one of the most amazing environmental research programs in the entire world. I mean, literally, this program is world-renowned. And so there was a huge uproar, but the conservatives were determined to close it. And again, it's something that, of course, it's the environment. Of course you want to be able to understand better the long-term impacts of various chemical substances on lakes, on different environments. You know, they cut the funding for that. It was pretty awful. At the end of the day, the Ontario government rescued the program, and so it is continuing, somewhat reduced budget-wise, but it is continuing thanks to the Ontario government. And even then, when the handover was a little dicey. I guess the Conservatives didn't want quite the Ontario government to restore it and get the researchers back there as quickly as maybe other people might have wanted.
Was that science gossip? That's great.
No, that was reported. There was a little bit of tension around the handover, so it was kind of interesting.
Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about the National Research Council changes. Now, when was that?
The NRC has, I guess, been kind of there's been again a kind of a slow drip of changes, changes of emphasis over the years. Same thing's been happening at NSERC again. There's been an emphasis on promoting more applied research rather than pure research, which is kind of interesting. I think most people would say that you need to balance pure and applied research. You can't, if you don't do any pure research, that's not a good way to have a vibrant scientific culture. And so the most recent announcement was that the NRC, they would change the focus of the NRC from mostly pure curiosity-driven research to mostly industry-sponsored applied research, which again was very controversial. You want to have this kind of really vibrant scientific culture. But the problem was, and the conservatives, I think, very clearly saw this problem, is Canadian companies actually kind of suck at doing R&D in
yes,
Canada.
Right.
Canada is way behind most other countries on the amount of industry-sponsored R&D that happens, which is awful. Right? That's the applied research that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. The NRC shouldn't be doing applied research. All these companies should be doing applied research. If it makes sense to make money off of applied research, the industry should be investing that money. The NRC should concentrate on the stuff that industry that where it doesn't make sense
right.
for industry to kick. You know, most companies, except the very largest, don't have the resources to have a 5, 10, 20 year time frame. They just can't. But the NRC, government-funded research, should be about having that time frame. It's complex too, because when you're a government bean counter and you look at the research in the NRC, right? If you go to a lab and you say, okay, where's the products that came from your research, right? So you go to a lab that does applied pure research, right? Where are the products that come from your research? That's a really hard question to answer, because that's not really the way science works.
Right?
Science is cumulative. You can't say, oh, this lab learned this thing about the cell, and oh, that immediately led to this drug development. And so that's what government bean counters want to be able to see. They want to be able to see that direct connection, and that connection is really hard to make. You need to be able to say, this lab made a contribution to the understanding of a certain process or something that ultimately led to this product.
Isn't that how it used to be, though, is that the pure research was done by governments and by universities, and sort of the applied part of it was done by companies?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're a bit past the golden age when a Bell Labs or something like that or IBM would do a lot of pure research. Once upon a time, there was a fair bit of pure research that was done in industry labs. That era is kind of gone.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, once upon a time, governments funded pure research and companies funded applied research. We're past that.
I just want to upgrade all my previous comments from depressing to this being vaguely traumatic.
Yes.
Okay.
And this has happened in universities too, right? The governments want, the provincial governments too, want the research that happens in universities to be much more applied and much more targeted, much more focused on that kind of detailed level of accountability. One of the things that I found really amusing about when the government, I guess it was Gary Goodyear, when they announced, anyways, I think it was Gary Goodyear that did the announcement for the NRC changes. The example they used was the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany, and said, okay, look, we want the NRC to be just like this institute in Germany. Look how successful it's been with applied research. That's where we want to go. And so, being your typical Canadian, okay, I thought to myself, the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany, I don't know anything about this. So immediately what I did was I went on Twitter, and I asked a couple of my German scientific friends, what's the story with this? And of course I got the story back. And actually Germany has a lot of institutes, some of which do applied research, some of which very famous, incredibly famous institutes like the Max Planck Institute. And I'm thinking, oh yeah, the Max Planck Institute, of course I've heard of them. They're one of the most famous research institutes in the world that do pure research. So again, they kind of tried to pull the wool over our eyes a bit, I think, by saying, oh, look what the Germans are doing, and picking the one little thing, okay, that's the institute that does really successful applied research. But they weren't giving us the whole story, right? They were kind of assuming that, most Canadians don't have famous scientist friends in Germany
right.
that they can ask. And by the way, thanks to Bjorn Brems and Martin Fenner who answered my questions for me. And so, yeah, I think that's a pretty telling that, right, they try to give us half a story about what's happening somewhere else. And you know, and it's not like I don't think that the NRC should do any applied research. They've actually had a lot of successes with applied research, you know, in particular in their early days. But it's really all about balance, right? You know, the government, you know, when you look at the macro level, that kind of government sponsored research should concentrate on the kinds of things that it makes sense for the government to sponsor in terms of research. And that's pure research, because the companies won't do that. You know, what the government needs to do is figure out how to make or how to encourage industry to pay for their own research.
I just have to say something for all the Americans that heard us say Gary Goodyear and we laughed. I'm not going to go into it. I just want you guys to Google Gary Goodyear evolution and you'll see why we were laughing.
Absolutely. And to our American friends, they can also Google a minister of oil.
Oh, good times.
Good times. That would be Joe Oliver.
I really want you to point out the cuts around Library and Archives of Canada, because that was atrocious.
Oh yeah, because I so totally have to talk about this. Library and Archives Canada. Well, Library and Archives Canada is a heritage institution. There is this kind of a separate science library infrastructure in Canada, and which has also actually been completely devastated. You know, the first one, the NRC used to actually have a science library called CISTI, the Canada Institute of Scientific and Technical Information, and that was actually the canary in the scientific coal mine. They were the first place that the Conservatives targeted, and you know, a bunch of different libraries were closed over. You know, I think again the most significant one was the Department of Fisheries and Oceans Library that was closed recently. I mean, literally, it's like, you know, a library full of unique information, stuff that just doesn't exist anywhere else. You know, an amazing historical treasure in terms of scientific information about fisheries and oceans. And it's like, yeah, we just got to get rid of all these collections. They weren't going to, you know, Library and Archives Canada couldn't take it. They're not allowed to take that kind of stuff anymore, I think. And so it was like, okay, if the employees just want to take the stuff home, go for it.
For real.
And so, again, this treasure trove of irreplaceable information is largely lost. Hopefully most of it will be sitting on a dusty shelf in a university library somewhere. And if somebody knew the name of a report, they could actually track it down. I mean, that's kind of what I hope. But anyways, so Library and Archives Canada, a heritage institution. In terms of the kind of war on evidence that I was talking about, I think the main impact here is on the kinds of research that, say, historians would do, and the kinds of materials that archivists would use. The most recent outrage, and again, I'd like to thank the Bibliocracy blog, Myron Gruber posted this a couple of days ago. There's this thing called Canadiana, which is a database of digitized heritage materials. And the Library and Archives Canada has had some really, really deep cuts over the last few years, letting go a lot of the frontline librarians, closing down a lot of really important programs, like the National Archival Development Program, like the Canadian Council of Archives. And so these were well-developed, well-established programs that were eliminated, that would support local archives to preserve local historical materials, to make them accessible, to do archival training, to get people in kind of, you know, local libraries, local historical societies trained on how to do a lot of the work themselves. And so, you know, a huge, huge impact on the kind of work that historians and social scientists do. And so what happened was, is the government, got rid of their own capacity to do this kind of digital archival work. And so what was reported from the most recent Canadian Library Association conference was that they're in the Library and Archives Canada are in talks with Canadiana, it's a nonprofit, to essentially outsource a lot of the digitization work that LAC does. And then what they would do is, so in other words, the Canadian heritage materials that are part of the Library and Archives collection, digitizing that material will be outsourced to this other organization. And then what they're going to do is they're going to set up a paywall. So then Canadians will have to go back and pay to get access. Wonderful. But it's not even over.
No.
That's only the most recent outrage.
I can't take any more, John.
It's okay. You'll get off the phone and have a drink. I'll get off the phone and I'll have a drink.
I'm 2 seconds away from going fetal. Okay, so...
We were talking about muzzling before, right?
Right.
Now, that's happening in Library and Archives Canada as well. Library and Archives Canada has a dedicated group of professional librarians and archivists who have historically been incredibly active within librarian professional circles within Canada. I mean, so you go to a conference, there'll be people from LAC there, and they'll be presenting, they'll be talking, they'll be doing the good work of spreading the librarian message throughout the world. And so now they have a code of conduct. The employees at Library and Archives Canada have a code of conduct. Just like the scientists, if they want to contribute in professional conferences, go out and do teaching and other things, once again, these are high-risk activities, apparently, and they have to ask permission from their bosses to effectively contribute to the profession. They also have to. They also need to profess a duty of loyalty to the government. Not to Canada, right? But a duty of loyalty, and that's fairly common that public employees do have kind of a duty of loyalty. But it's usually you're not going to make it in neon letters in your code of conduct, right? So again, that's that strong emphasis on okay. We want to know what you're going to say. We're going to want to know where you're going to say it. We're going to want to know who you're going to say it to, and you take your order. You know, you have this loyalty to the government, so you have to listen to what, so you have to do what we tell you. You have to. So yeah, it was hugely controversial within the Canadian library and archivist communities, because again, it just goes against it goes against everything that we want to stand for, which is kind of sharing and collaboration. And again, so if you wanted to get an archivist to do a presentation to school kids, right, they got to ask for permission first. And this extends to the code of conduct, even extends to things that they would do in their personal lives.
I think I'm ill. So looking at all this together, what does this all mean? Like about society, about science, about the government, about, I don't know, people's interest in evidence-based decision making. What, you can go anywhere you'd like with that.
I think it means that we're in a tough spot, right? I guess we are where the United States were, a year or two before Obama was elected. I'm hoping we're at the low point in the trough, and there's nowhere to go but up. Certainly within the House of Commons, there are people on the opposition benches that are huge supporters of science. One of them being the NDP. There's an NDP MP from BC named Kennedy Stewart, who pulled a really fun trick on the government this past March in the House of Commons. Maybe that's for another time. But Mark Garneau is in the House of Commons, right?
We're totally into insider baseball now, sir.
Right.
My poor American listeners are like, I don't even understand
sure.
what you're talking about.
Yeah, the NDP, those are the communists.
Right.
Right. And so there's a science-loving communist in the House of Commons. There's a science-loving communist in the House of Commons. And this past March, he actually, by tying this into the Experimental Lakes Area closure, he actually got the government MPs, I've got it right here, to vote against public science, basic research, and the free and open exchange of scientific information are essential to evidence-based policymaking. He got them to vote against federal government scientists must be enabled to discuss openly their findings with their colleagues and the public.
Why would they vote against that?
Well, because item C was the federal government should maintain support for its basic scientific capacity across Canada, including immediately extending funding until a new operator is found to the world-renowned Experimental Lakes Area Research Facility. So in other words, he kind of tricked them into voting against motherhood and apple pie, because they both also had to vote for the Experimental Lakes Area. So,
okay,
so yes, that's what the crazy communists.
We're pre-American. This is not reassuring.
Right, and you know, Canadians have always liked to think of themselves as kind of kinder and gentler and smarter than Americans.
I think.
By the way, to the American listeners, we've always thought that.
Yeah. but this list proves that we are not very far off.
Apparently, people are people, and it doesn't matter where they live.
John, I would like to say it was nice to have you here, but kinda. It was kinda nice to have you here.
It was kinda nice to be here.
You can find. Go ahead.
What I'm hoping is, like I said, we're at the bottom of the trough, and I see hope. I see the most famous science person in the world is a Canadian, Chris Hadfield.
Absolutely.
I see the people in the House of Commons fighting back. I see possibilities. So I'm hoping we can only go there. We're ending on a positive note. I'm hoping the future can only bring better things.
You are a lovely man. You honestly are. And honestly, for anybody who's listening, if you've never met a librarian, they are the most optimistic people ever, which is great because they need to be. And you can find John Dupuy and his post on the Canadian War on Science on Confessions of a Science Librarian at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You'll also find links to Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and iTunes for all your keeping up with Skeptically Speaking needs. This is Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back with Chris McDonald to talk about the power of critical thinking. Stay tuned.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's an hour on the evolution of language. Linguist, philosopher, author, and activist Noam Chomsky joins us to discuss the concept of universal grammar and the possibility of a human genetic capacity to create and use language. Terence Deacon, chair of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley, talks about the structure of language and how some common features might be required to make language useful. And we'll speak to biologist Khan Slobodchikov, director of the Animal Language Institute, about his book Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. My next guest is Chris McDonald, who teaches ethics and critical thinking at Ryerson University's Ted Rogers School of Management, where he's director of the Jim Pattison Ethical Leadership Program. A philosopher by training, he's published widely on a range of issues related to business ethics, healthcare ethics, and professional ethics. He's the co-author of the best-selling Canadian edition of a textbook called The Power of Critical Thinking, and the author of a popular blog about business ethics, the Business Ethics Blog, where he tries to apply fundamental critical thinking skills to ethical issues in the world of business. Chris, lovely to have you back on the show.
Good to be here.
And so let's start with the basics. First of all, your textbook was not boring, and that is weird.
Yeah, that's one of the positive bits of feedback we get on the textbook is that we try to keep it light. We try to keep it, we're serious about the subject matter, but we try to have fun with it.
Well, let's start with the basics. What's the definition of critical thinking so that we're all on the same page?
Well, the sort of textbook definition is that critical thinking is the systematic evaluation or formulation of beliefs or statements by rational standards. But essentially, critical thinking is really figuring out what to believe and reflecting on why some things are worth believing and others aren't.
Well, what's the difference between logic and critical thinking?
Well, logic is a big part of critical thinking, at least informally. Logic is fundamentally the study of what follows from what statements or claims can reasonably be inferred or deduced from what other claims. And so we teach some of that in most critical thinking courses. But for most critical thinking, the logic employed is pretty informal. You don't need to be able to do proofs in the language of deductive logic, for example, in order to do critical thinking.
Thank goodness. So I suppose you've noticed that not everyone is a fan of critical thinking, not just because it sounds difficult or even kind of boring to some people, but there does seem to be a sense that thinking critically is somehow negative.
Yeah, there seem to be people out there who think that, anytime you want to raise a point that smells like critical thinking, you're somehow being negative. And I think there are, a couple of ways that people express that. sometimes people say, well, you know, we all have our opinions and I'm entitled to my own point of view. And that's, at some level, that's absolutely true. But of course, the fact that you're entitled to your point of view, as long as you're not bothering anyone else, that doesn't mean that I should adopt your point of view. And very often we're talking about public or semi-public debate, where the whole objective is to figure out what the best point of view to share is. The other thing that people sometimes argue or propose is that you shouldn't be so critical because it's good to be open-minded. You should keep an open mind. And of course, we all know that that's good only up to some point. There's always a point at which, you know, you want to say, well, there are some things we're pretty sure of, and, you know, we want to think critically, not just have the open mind in the sense of allowing just any and everything into it. That would be pretty lethal.
So then if you were going to sell critical thinking to somebody, what would you say to them? Why is it so important?
You know, it's important for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, one of the fundamental sort of human desires is we want the stuff in our heads to be true, right? We've got all this stuff in our heads and we want it to be true. And there's two ways for that to happen. One, you know, in some cases, you can try and change the world to fit the stuff in your head. So, you know, we want our hopes and dreams to come true, and it's great to work hard to try and achieve that. More often, the thing you need to do is to change the stuff in your head to make sure that it matches reality. And that's kind of what critical thinking is about trying to figure out of all this, you know, massive flood of information that comes into your brain every day, which bits are worth keeping and which aren't. And one of the ways we explain this in the textbook is we say it's about taking ownership. If you don't reflect on and endorse critically the stuff that's in your head, those beliefs, then they're in some sense not really yours. They're just stuff you've inherited. They're, you know, the equivalent of stuff you saw written on a bathroom wall somewhere. So if you're accepting things uncritically, you're just kind of chaff in the wind being blown this way and that, and it's kind of undignified. For practical purposes, the way I would explain it is that thinking critically to figure out what to believe is an absolutely crucial skill for making good decisions. And that's why I'm interested in teaching critical thinking at business schools, because business is all about making decisions and we want people to make good ones rather than bad ones.
So then what's the first step in thinking critically, or maybe we should say effectively evaluating claims or arguments? Where do we start?
Well, there's a couple of things to say. I think the simplest way, and the way that I find myself diving into critical thinking on a daily basis, is with one word, and it's the word really. Anytime someone, you know, I find myself sitting a lot listening to other people present, you know, do presentations or lectures, or I'm reading something, and at the end of a sentence I just say, really? Is that really true? And, you know, are you sure? Am I sure? How do we know that? How do, you know, why do we believe that? Especially if someone started the sentence with surely. You know, what's the support for that? Why am I taking that for granted? And, you know, of course, it would be exhausting to ask really at the end of every sentence. But in principle, that's what you want to do, right? You want to have your sort of critical thinking antennae up so that, you know, at the end of every sentence, you're effectively, you know, implicitly asking, really, what's the, you know, what support have I been offered for that? The other thing to do, the other sort of key step is to get a better grasp on the understanding, on understanding sort of the structure of arguments, the structure of how it is that we provide evidence for our claims. And so that's why, you know, in my courses, I get my students to be really explicit and do sort of flow chart diagrams of arguments. And really, it's one of those things, it's like certain kinds of math puzzles, I guess, where the point isn't so much to do the diagram. The point is to get the idea into your head that arguments have a rational structure, or at least they ought to, right? That when you're putting forward a point of view and trying to support it with good reasons, it's not just a random flow of ideas. It's not just a stream of consciousness. That there will be, you know, a main conclusion supported by some reasons, which we, you know, call premises in the sort of technical jargon, and that those premises can in turn then themselves be supported by reasons. And once we think of argumentation that way, I think it really changes the way your brain works. It changes sort of the way you approach gaining new knowledge.
Well, what if there's basically absolutely no evidence for a belief? Then what?
Well, then I think the default setting should be that if the question at hand is important at all, then you don't believe the thing for which there's no evidence. It just doesn't make sense. It's just not rational. And for that matter, if you want to take it as a question of character, it's undignified as a grown-up human being to believe things for which there's absolutely no evidence. I mean, if you set that standard for yourself, right? If you say, oh, I just believe things, I mean, that's just sort of incompatible with continued existence on Earth. You're just not going to survive very long if you literally took that as your standard.
How would one effectively argue with someone who's holding a belief that is solely based on personal experience? Because there's a lot of those.
I think that's very difficult for two reasons. I think one reason it's difficult is that some of the things you need to say in response are relatively technical, not technical in a, you know, this isn't, we're not talking about quantum physics here, but I hope not anyway, though in some cases, you know, some of the things you want to be able to say, look, you know, we know from the history of human thought that personal observation is subject to a whole bunch of biases. And then, of course, the person says, well, what do you mean by biases? Are you saying I'm biased? That's a mean thing to say. And so you end up having to sort of explain a bit about, you know, confirmation bias and about, you know, the reasons why we don't trust firsthand experience all the time. And that can get you into some sort of semi-technical philosophical, some bits of epistemology that people are not always going to be comfortable with. And it's not very handy for sort of casual online discussion. The other reason, of course, is pride, right? When someone says, look, I saw it with my own eyes, it's vaguely insulting to say, well, are you sure?
Right.
And so I think that immediately gets people's backs up, and that's really difficult. This is just sort of a fundamental, and now we're getting into the realm where, you know, how do you convince people? That's more a matter of psychology at some point than of philosophy.
Can we touch briefly on correlation versus causation? Because that is a very tricky area, and we are very bad at figuring that out. So first of all, why are we so bad at figuring that out?
I mean, the basic problem of sorting out correlation versus causation is that, you know, the simple fact that two phenomena seem to go hand in hand doesn't automatically mean that one of them caused the other. And the challenge is that, you know, our brains are kind of our own worst enemy here, because our brains are, it's seemingly designed to impose order on the world, right? We get this massive chaotic stream of input from our eyes and ears and our other senses. We have this massive sensory input, and our brains are given the task of sort of building a story out of this, right? And I'm not a scientist, but my understanding of some of the science is that there's a real sense in which our brains actually sort of confabulate a story. They sort of make a story. We are wired to make a story even when there's no story to be made. And so, you know, we get all this input, and so when we see one billiard ball hit another, we immediately think, oh, that one made that one move, right? That's how we make sense of the scene. Or I drank some herbal tea, and then I felt better. And so we immediately say, oh, well, the tea cured my cold, right? So our brains give us a story. And to the best we can tell, you know, our brains are just not just good at making stories. They're like, you know, excellent at making stories. They are like driven to make stories. Regardless of whether there's, you know, I mean, this is the equivalent of, you know, sitting on the bus and picking two people at random and inventing, you know, why they must be estranged lovers or something like that. It's just, you know, it's a fun pastime, and our brains are.
There are other people that do that.
Yeah, I think that's
awesome.
another thing that that unites us all. But the problem is that this powerful sort of sense making tool that is our brains sometimes go awry, because coincidences do happen. In fact, it's kind of, you know, coincidences are more common than arguably anything else. I mean, at any given moment, there are millions of things that just happen to be happening at the same time. In fact, there's probably literally an infinity of them. And so what's important is to figure out which ones matter, right? Which coincidences are actually meaningful, right? The fact that, you know, my cat is doing something right now, and that your cat is doing something right now on the other side of the country, probably not meaningful unless it's some, you know, that at least is not going to be connected except by sort of the basics of cat psychology. But we need to figure out which ones are meaningful. You know, like the fact that when I touch the stove You know, touching the stove and getting burned tend to go hand in hand. That's a really important correlation, and that's a correlation that is connected to it. I mean, there is a causal story to tell there. And so we need to figure out which, you know, which ones going hand in hand are meaningful, right? So, of several different pharmaceuticals that I might be on, which one was really responsible for putting my cancer into remission, or, you know, that sort of thing. Those are the figuring out the causal stories from the mere coincidences is incredibly important, fundamentally important to sort of to our basic survival, but incredibly difficult.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is Chris McDonald, who teaches ethics and critical thinking at Ryerson University. Let's try and make this really tangible. So how would someone do something like think critically about a science news story? Sort of, can you walk us through that, what that would look like?
Yeah, sure. I mean, science stories are, you know, a really important category, and also, you know, one where, you know, just a little bit of understanding of how science works, right? And I do mean a little bit. I'm not a scientist, right? But I teach students how to sort of look for the key markers. So there's a bunch of things you can do. I mean, the first thing to do is to look at things like, well, what's the claim being made, and is the claim being made in a reputable venue, right? So is this a result that was, for example, you know, published in a prominent medical journal, which is not, you know, not a guarantee, but an awfully good sign, because if you know a little bit about the medical journals, you know that in order to get published in one, you at least have to go through a process known as peer review, which means you have experts in your field read your work and sort of verify that you've at least dotted your I's and crossed your T's. Which is, again, not a guarantee that everything is great in what you've said, or certainly not proof that it's true, but it's a good kind of marker. Other things you can do would include, you know, looking at, for example, is this result that's been announced, is it sort of the result of one experiment? And sometimes those can be very exciting. Sometimes those can be really dramatic. But typically, if you understand the way science works, scientists don't tend to consider an issue settled by a single experiment, except in some very special kinds of circumstances where a particular kind of experiment, if it's well done, can really provide a lot of evidence. Generally, what you want to know about is repetition, right? So not just, you know, did someone demonstrate that, you know, this particular compound killed cancer cells in a petri dish, but, you know, has a string of experiments carried out by different people in different places demonstrated that that this compound kills cancer in a petri dish. And even then, you want to make sure you recognize the difference between laboratory tests, right, sort of, or in vitro tests done in test tubes or in petri dishes in a laboratory, as opposed to things like, you know, studies that are done sort of in their natural setting. So in medical or biomedical cases, right, we'd want to know, for example, does this new result merely show that such and such kills cancer in a petri dish, or has it actually cured anyone, right? Has it actually been shown to be effective clinically? And that's an important difference. So I think, you know, knowing a little bit about how science works, that science is about careful forming a hypothesis, testing it carefully, and then repeating it, right? Repeating the process, knowing, for example, that generally what science provides is little bits of evidence, little tiny bits of evidence, and that the scientific process is one that involves lots and lots and lots of those little bits of evidence until they build up and are at some point become nearly irresistible.
Are you optimistic that a whole bunch of people are going to learn this real quick by any chance?
No.
Right.
No. I mean, the science thing? No. No, I think we've got a long way to go on scientific literacy. But again, one of the things I point out to my students is you don't need to know much, right? So I have a section in one of my introductory lectures where I do thinking critically about human cloning, right? Just because it's a fun topic. And I teach them, and I remind them that I'm not a scientist, but I teach them enough about the science of cloning in 60 seconds to help them see through some of the worst arguments about human cloning, right? I mean, that hasn't been much on the table the last little while, but every once in a while, this topic of human cloning pops up and people put forward all kinds of silly arguments. you only need a tiny bit of science to remedy that. And that I think is something to be optimistic about.
Chris, always good to have you here.
My pleasure.
You can find a link to Chris McDonald and the Business Ethics blog on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And honestly, check out his textbook. Again, it is not boring, and I don't know how he accomplished that. And since you're there already, do check out the links to Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and iTunes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our guest coordinators are Rochelle Saunders and Ed Haynes. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillon is our publications coordinator. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.